bottle of port and managed to spill a good measure over our feet.
"That's for later," I confided. "I'll be able to suck that out of my boot on the way home." I went back to dancing while Philip took a breather, sitting back at his handmade table, running his fingers idly over the surface. "One day," he mused, "I'd like to build something bigger. A lot bigger. No, a lot bigger." He rapped his knuckles hard against the wood. "Like a house," he added. "We could just buy a block of land, you know, the four of us, and have a go." I laughed. Well, snorted, really. The women laughed. The idea was absurd. We all ignored it and kept dancing. 6 months later, I was in a car, sitting beside Philip, bumping down a dirt track somewhere in the bush north of Sydney. We were trying to buy a block of rural land on which we could build a house from scratch, using our own labour. It was an absurd proposition. Even as I navigated down the bush track, I couldn't believe I had agreed to something so unlikely. I didn't have the skills to change a light bulb. I had trouble differentiating a chisel from a screwdriver. I had never used a circular saw. There was no way I could take part in building a house. Philip was my best friend, but we were a study in opposites. He was stocky, with a barrel chest, dark skin, and curly black hair. At school, he'd been a champion weightlifter, and his body was still compact and muscly. He was a dedicated law student, but read fiction voraciously, setting himself the challenge of reading every new Australian novel. He had a certainty about him, a self-confidence that I envied. I was paler, thinner, more neurotic, my head and shoulders drooping apologetically forward like a letter R. I thought of myself as a bit frayed, as if I could unravel at any time. I found it hard to be in the moment, always feeling as if I was watching myself and passing judgment on my own behaviour. It was as if my brain was not in my own body, but perpetually hovering above it, a mordant, black-hearted crow. I'd never been a practical, hands-on sort of guy, more the wan, bookish type. From the age of 12 or 13, my main hobby had been the local youth theatre club. Much of my adolescence had been spent lying on my back pretending I was a melting ice cream or running in circles, my arms flapping, embodying the spirit of the north wind. You'd have been impressed. I was the spitting image. At school, they had tried and failed to make a man of me. Forced into the rugby union team, the coach would scream from the sidelines, "Glover, pick up a ball, run with it." "Can't, sir," I'd yell back. "Might get hurt, sir." At athletics, they'd try to get me to jog with the others around the field. "Well," I'd say, "since you'll all be back so soon, would you mind terribly if I just waited here?" I'd even scribbled ballet on my school sports form, taking advantage of a loophole which allowed boys to fulfill their sport commitments with out-of-school activities. The school authorities had in mind such manly pursuits as yachting, fencing, and mountaineering. Yet for 2 terms, they let me off twice a week to attend the Belconnen Ballet Centre, where I produced some of the worst performances ever seen in the history of modern dance. "It's good to have a boy in the class," the teacher had observed, contemplating her troupe of 29 girls and one boy. "But it would be marvellous if you were strong enough to lift any one girl more than an inch off the ground." At age 15, I even got into a serious schoolyard fight. Of course, it was over a novel. As I sat on the grass reading during lunch hour, some scoundrel stomped on my book, a treasured copy of P.G. Wodehouse's Right-Ho Jeeves. "Dash it all, man," I protested, jumping to my feet. "You can't step on another chap's book." In my choice of words, I may have been overly influenced by my reading material. In fact,